Hello and welcome to another episode of eDiscovery Chicks, the podcast about all things eDiscovery and legal tech, hosted by two gals who are extremely excited about today's guest. We are your hosts. That's Bree.
And that's Angie. And today we're talking about missing persons, and it wasn't our fault. But before we get to that,
Or was it?
Yeah. Dun, dun, dun. But before we get to that, I have to check in with you, Angie, because since we talked last time, you have now run a half marathon. Like, what in the world? Like, is there anything in the world that you can't do?
Oh, my God. Everything hurts and I'm dying. No. I ran Eugene yesterday and then had to sit in a car for like 6 hours with a toddler who, let me tell you, if I hear Old MacDonald Had a Farm one more time, I think I might just spontaneously combust.
I remember those days.
Oh, it's so miserable. And for whatever reason, my child does not stop. She cannot abide silence, right? And so every single moment is filled with some sort of soliloquy about sheep or fire trucks or forklifts or mixer trucks or whatever. And it just goes on and on and on. And when I got home, I was like, oh my God, I just need to be in silence like so badly.
Well, I'm so proud of you for doing that. I know you were training for that for a long time. So congratulations.
Yeah, it was really fun. So I had ankle surgery in November. Since then, shaved 10 minutes off my half marathon time, which I think is a testament, A, to how screwed up my ankle was, B, B, to how good my surgeon was.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I'm so happy for you.
Yay, thanks. Well,
before we move on anymore, we have to introduce a very special guest today. So without further ado, Mel Turnquist has 20 years of nonprofit development, community education, and training experience. Mel's going to be joining us today to be talking about missing peeps. And she's the perfect person to talk to us about this because she is the CEO of the Texas Center of the Missing. She's responsible for financial accountability, board development, marketing, education, and outreach, and fund development. Mel is also responsible for the creation of the center's digital law enforcement missing persons resource kit. She serves on the Harris County Child Abuse Task Force Board and the Human Trafficking Advisory Council serving Harris County. She also chairs the Kinsman Generosity Team. Prior to her 19-year tenure at Texas Center for the Missing, Mel was a major gifts officer at United Way, Greater Houston, where she trained hundreds of volunteers on campaign best practices and grew the women's initiative from a $10,000 campaign into a $1 million campaign. Well, Melissa is also, maybe quite possibly the greatest achievement ever, whoop, is a graduate from Texas A&M University. Welcome, Mel. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you both for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
We were sitting here talking right before we got on about how crazy busy we all are because, as you just heard Angie talking about, her, she's running half marathon, she has a toddler, she has a business, she has a podcast, she has a million things going on. Mel, you've only done 50,000 million things in your career, but you also have your own family. And I know that I met you through the PTO, so you're very involved with your kiddos. And so I wonder from you guys, when life gets crazy and you're having to deal with kids and you're having to deal with schedules and you're traveling and all the things, what is like the best stress relief for you guys? Like, how do you unwind?
I think mine is kind of a hybrid, like most of us as moms and just working peeps. We tend to multitask where we can. I'm an older mom, and so I want to be around as long as I can. And so sometimes that means riding my exercise bike in the living room with my family as we're either catching up or watching some silly television show together and just finding a way to prioritize what's going to give me some mental health breaks, but also having that family time.
That's great. That's a healthy choice. Mm-hmm. I don't think my choices are as healthy as
not always a universal decision, I will say. Sometimes it is the happy margarita time.
I can definitely get into some happy margarita time.
Always. Is Xanax the wrong answer? them. No, I think mine's the same. Like running for me is it. There's this meme of this woman and it's her making this like gross face. The like caption is go for a 2-hour run every weekend. And she's like, ugh, gross face. And then it's like 2 hours of non-parenting uninterrupted me time. And it's her making this like, okay, face. And that's sort of how I feel about it. It's like, okay, this is when I get my peace and quiet.
Yeah. Well, that's a really good way to look at it. I don't know if my body would appreciate 2 hours of running, but I admire that you can. I've always been into arts, and for a long time growing up, that was music, and I sang a lot. So I still really enjoy music, but I recently got into watercolor painting. And so when I want to sit down and do something that's not self-destructive, then I will sit down and paint some with my watercolor. So and I actually got to do that this weekend with a good friend of mine. So it's nice to be able to chillax for a minute.
And may I just say that you are actually an incredible painter.
I've seen your
work and it is so good.
Well, I only show the stuff that I am not terribly embarrassed by. There's some terrible pieces that I'm trying to do.
I don't believe
that. Well, before we get started here, I thought I would briefly discuss the intersection of your organization and what it really means from an e-discovery perspective. In recent episodes, Angie and I have been discussing the intersection of forensics and e-discovery. They kind of go together like peanut butter and jelly, shall we say. But forensics, as we know, is used many times in the investigation of crimes such as kidnapping and sex trafficking and child pornography, etc. Tools and processes used in e-discovery can help aid these investigations, as anybody that's been in our industry has known. And it's actually become more and more common that forensic examiners are working with e-discovery professionals so that we can dissect what we're finding in our forensics and tell the story that we need to tell for legal purposes through other findings in e-discovery. I have also mentioned as we've had these different episodes that I've had some personal history with this topic. And I've never really shared with anyone publicly on the podcast anyway, what that really means for me. And so I thought this might be a good time to share that because it really does relate very closely to why I asked Mel to be here today and why this episode is very important to all three of us. But the fact is, when I was 5 years old, I was kidnapped from my front yard, actually. My mom had gone inside for a moment and some perpetrator took the moment to drive by in his car and coerce me into his car and I went. And as a result, I was sexually molested and returned back home, thank God, a few hours later. This experience was obviously terrible, and it took me many, many years to overcome the trauma from this. And just from like a bird's eye view, I'll explain a little bit about what that means. But what it meant for me as a kid is that I grew up with a very, very low self-esteem, feeling like I was damaged, feeling like I should be ashamed of myself, feeling like I was stupid, like I did something wrong and it was all my fault. And I know logically that anybody listening would say, why would you think that? That's not even true. But when you're 5 and that happens to you, that's your natural reaction. Thank goodness I went to counseling many, many, many times in my life for all kinds of things. But that subject has come up many times, even into adulthood, because it was the fundamental way that my self-esteem became developed, which is very flawed. And a lot of things happened as a result, meaning like I didn't want to speak up in school because I was stupid. I didn't want to have friends because I didn't want them to know my dirty secret, that I never thought that I was good enough for fill in the blank. So I'm saying all this not because I want empathy or sympathy. I'm saying this just to be an example of what happens when women or children or men are put into situations where they're taken advantage of and abused. It doesn't just affect that moment in your life. It literally affects everything that you do. Of course, you come to a place where you're at peace, hopefully, with it, and you can heal and you can use it actually to help other people. And that's been very meaningful for me. But that's why this episode means a lot to me. And I know Mel and I know what she does. And watch her and her great work with the Texas Center of the Missing. And I just really wanted her to come on here and talk to us about this, because in our episode about deepfakes and in some episodes that we have coming up down the road, some of what is happening with forensics and with e-discovery is very much involved with these illegal behaviors, like the audio and the video that's being used to display pornographic events involving children, for example. Mm-hmm. So we thought it was pertinent, but I feel like I just went on a rant. So I'm going to stop talking and let you talk. So to get us started, Mel, can you tell us a bit about who the Texas Center for the Missing is and what your mission is all about?
Well, thank you, Bree. And Angie, thank you both for having me here. And Bree, especially thank you for sharing your personal story and experience, especially because Texas Center for the Missing's origin is rooted in another family's experience. Texas Center for the Missing was founded in March of 2000 after the disappearance of 17-year-old Gabriel Lester. He was reported missing from his private high school in Austin, and Gabe's mom was a Houston area businesswoman, and she decided after, sadly, Gabe's remains were found, she wanted to create an organization that could help walk with families through the scariest time in their lives. Gabe's story was a tragedy, but Doreen truly took it upon herself to try to come up with a way to help families. And over time, our mission has evolved. And so we strive every day to stay true to our founder's mission to help searching families find hope. We never want to leave any stone unturned. And everything we do in the community falls within three primary pillars. It's impact, prepare, and respond. We would love to put ourselves out of business, and that's the impact side, where we do prevention education, working with the community about different issues that impact missing persons, and to hopefully prevent anyone from going missing, which is part of what today is about, is that communication with the public. The prepare piece, that is our law enforcement partnership, where we train investigators on emergency alerts and missing persons investigations, including the laws surrounding these very complex cases. When I first came on board 19 years ago at Texas Center for the Missing, I was shocked that there was no missing persons investigation training in any police academy in Greater Houston. And so that's where we try to fill in those gaps. And then the respond is the on-call 24/7 to help families in crisis and the law enforcement investigators serving those families. Because I think it's important for people to understand that in Greater Houston, there's over 250 investigating agencies of different sizes. So you've got HPD, who has 15 investigators just in their missing persons unit. And then you may have the Missouri City Police Department. I don't know their exact size, but you know, they might have five for the entire jurisdiction. And so they have to be experts across the board. And so we try to help whatever size investigation agency may have, where do they need resources and connections across jurisdictions? And so we are the Amber Alert provider for Greater Houston. And I do want everyone to know there is zero government dollars to support regional Amber Alert programs. We do the Silver Alert, which is to help find those battling dementia. And then we also provide 24-hour resources and year-round training to law enforcement.
That's wonderful. Wow.
I know. You are such an inspiration. I mean, everything that you do on a daily basis is for the greater good. And that is just so cool. Now, Mel, in preparation for today's discussion, you shared a bunch of really compelling statistics about not only the impact that your organization has had, but also the Amber Alert and Silver Alerts that you just mentioned and other kind of related topics. So can you share some of those with our listeners so that they can better understand the scope, the scale, and the impact of what it is that you do?
Absolutely. I want to point out, I know some people get really irritated by their cell phones going off with Amber Alerts, but I want to remind folks that number one, those are the most at-risk children. An emergency alert is only activated if someone is at risk of bodily harm, sexual assault, or death. And so while that sound may be irritating, the Amber Alert has a 96% success rate. So please do pay attention. And if you're able, do, you know, keep your eyes open. That could save a child from what Bree experienced. I want to point out that Houston's Amber Alert is credited. We know 221 children were saved as a direct result of our Amber Alert, and that's 10% of the national results. And that's partly because Houston is such a huge geographic region, but also because we have a dedicated individual who trained law enforcement and is on call 24/7. Last year, we know that Texas Center for the Missing reunited 68 families, and that goes across the board. Sometimes people, when they hear missing, they just think kids. Primarily, most of our emergency alerts are now for our aging parents battling dementia. So any missing person is of concern to us as an entity. We had 10 Amber Alerts and 28 Silver Alerts last year. So that kind of gives you a sense of scope. And within that, another thing to remember is last year, there were over 9,000 missing children reported in our region and over 4,000 missing adults. And so while that number seems large, I also want to compare that to those number of emergency alerts. It's a very small fraction. So when you see those emergency alerts, those are your highest risk individuals.
Could you, just in case some of our listeners don't know, explain the difference between an Amber and a Silver Alert?
You bet. And we actually do four. So I'm going to really bore you with this. So the Amber Alert is for a juvenile under the age of 18 who it's believed they've been kidnapped or they're missing in suspicious circumstances. And for all four of the alerts, the key, you're going to hear me say these words over and over again, an imminent danger of bodily harm, sexual assault, or death. That is the criteria for an investigator. If they believe that through their investigation for any of these individuals populations that I'm about to discuss, that's the trigger. And so sometimes when you've got your Monday morning quarterbacking going on, oh, well, that child was never in danger. Well, you know that now. But during the investigation, there was enough evidence to raise that child's case to a high enough risk that an Amber Alert was activated. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be the one that all of us should keep our eyes open for. Silver Alert, I just tie it to silver hair. A presumption that's anyone who's 65 or older who's been diagnosed with any form of dementia like Alzheimer's. A big statistic people need to know is that someone with Alzheimer's, if they're missing for 24 hours or more, there's a 50% chance they won't be found alive. It's because of medication, and especially in our Houston region, the extreme weather circumstances we have. When you do wander, if you've got Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia, you're not dressing yourself properly to survive. Mm-hmm. So those are our two biggest risk populations. The other endangered missing persons alert, my shorthand in my mind, that's for individuals on the autistic spectrum or any other sort of developmental disability, otherly intellectually functioning, shall we say. And that's for any age. A lot of individuals with autism, especially with the summer months coming up, they're drawn to water. And so it's a big piece of our summer education programs to teach people how to keep their pools safe from those wandering kids with autism or young adults with autism. We've actually used that endangered missing persons alert for early onset dementia cases because the silver alert's for 65 or older. Some folks have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's or dementia as early as 45 or 50. So that's when the endangered missing persons alert can go out. And then there's a clear alert. And that's if an individual adult age group between 18 and 65, that they're believed to have been abducted or kidnapped. And they are, again, in danger of bodily harm, sexual assault, or death. And that is named for a young woman who unfortunately was inebriated and got into an Uber, what she believed to have been an Uber, and it wasn't. And that bad actor ended up sexually assaulting her and killing her. And that mother became an advocate for what do we do for this other population? If there is evidence this person is in danger, what do we do? And that's where the clear alert comes into play. So that's a lot of information, but that's how you break it down.
That. You know, I wanted to just throw in there too, and thank you for the reminder that we shouldn't be annoyed, because I have been annoyed by them, I'll just admit, because they seem to come at like the most inopportune times. But, you know, even for somebody who's gone through this themselves, I get annoyed. I know other people must as well. If you can save a kid or an adult or someone from the situation at all, of course, that's a great thing to do. And I realize that my kidnapping experience was very minor in compared to what traditionally may happen when somebody is kidnapped. And I certainly have relived in my own mind, like, God, what if I had been brutally raped? What if I had been killed? What if I, you know, there's a bunch of what ifs. Mm-hmm. And so I just encourage you to heed Mel's words there. And I appreciate you sharing that. Was there any other statistics that you wanted to share before we move on here?
I mean, I think part of it, too, is sometimes our law enforcement partners get the kind of short end of the stick where families may think they're not doing anything. I just want to throw this other statistic out there. For our two largest agencies in the greater Houston area, they were responsible for 10,700 cases last year and had 18 investigators. So this is not, it's always, most of our investigators are going to be in a triage mode. And as we talk about other ways that individuals can advocate for their missing loved one, it's important to remember that the caseload is so heavy, you really need to be an advocate for your loved one and share all the information, regardless of what may be embarrassing to you. Because something in your family member's past or some of their recent behaviors may be the key to find them. And it may escalate the focus of investigators that your loved one may be in danger. An example would be, I don't want to necessarily, I'm not saying this about my own family. However, if my family was missing and I had a teenage child who I knew was involved in drugs in some capacity, maybe I don't want to share that information with law enforcement to protect them. However, that might be an investigation path that could recover your child and find a way to get them home and also make that child's case have a higher level of risk. And so we just really need to be honest with investigators as much as possible.
That's great advice.
Yeah.
We have been talking about some statistics, and I think it's important to point out that Mel's organization is here in the greater Houston area, which is Houston and some surrounding suburbs, right? And we are a large city, but we're one city. So if you think about these organizations all over the United States, and do the math in your brain. I mean, then we're going to get into BreMath, and there's like 50,000 million other missing people out there, right? So talk to us a little bit about the process of reporting a missing person. How long does it take for them to actually be considered missing? And what are the immediate next steps? And kind of what is that? We would call it a workflow in our industry. What does that look like?
I love flowcharts as well. So, I mean, primarily the thing to remember is there is no 24-hour waiting period to report a missing person. I will probably say that five times in our conversation. Despite what popular television shows may be perpetuating, that is simply not the case and has never been the case in the state of Texas. As soon as anyone believes their loved one is missing, especially if they're in imminent danger of bodily harm or death, the steps are very simple. Step one, you report to law enforcement in the jurisdiction they were last seen. And some language that individuals should probably use is, I need to report a missing at-risk child. Or if it's an adult, especially if someone who has a diagnosis of autism or Alzheimer's dementia, I need to report an endangered missing adult. And that language will hopefully get you to the right missing persons unit in whichever jurisdiction you may reside in. After you do contact law enforcement, reach out to Texas Center for the Missing. If you're in the 14-county Houston-Galveston region, we are here to help. We have a Get Help form on our website at centerforthemissing.org. I do just want to say you have to do step one before you do step two, because the first thing our case manager will ask is, have you reported your loved one missing to law enforcement? And then step three is to remain calm and prepare for investigators to talk to you very detailed and be prepared to share all the information, regardless of how embarrassing you may find it. And just touching back on, you know, the things that you may find embarrassing about your family member's past or current lifestyle or living situation may be the key to bring them home. I kind of shared with y'all the workflow of what a case manager does. Every case is different. And so sometimes we can resolve a case within 24 hours. And sometimes it requires 30, 60, 90 day follow-ups. And we can constantly, as a case evolves, come up with new resources, which we'll talk about in a bit with the DNA submissions and the different things that become available the longer a missing person is still not returned home.
And I know we're talking about this in the context of Texas Center for the Missing, but are there similar organizations in other states and other jurisdictions?
Every state has a missing persons clearinghouse, which offers different resources, but there are a lot of different entities across the country. If anyone needs a referral for a specific region, we have a lot of partners all over the country that we can certainly connect people to. And all of our contact information is on our website at centerforthemissing.org.
Gotcha. What are some things that you wish people understood about this process?
again, I'm going to say this 100 times. There is no 24-hour waiting period to report a missing person. That's number one. And number two is a lot of families, when they're in a panic mode, they want to create a missing persons flyer or a social media post as soon as possible. The most important thing to remember is do not put personal contact information on any sort of post for a missing person. For instance, if I had a missing loved one, I would not put my personal cell phone on it. You would need to either put the investigating agency or Texas Center for the Missing. You should always put the investigating agency, and that's for two reasons. Number one, bad actors, the bad guys that are out there that are trolling social media, within 30 minutes, a lot of these searching families will get false ransom demands from these bad guys in our community. They don't know this person. They don't have the missing person. They're just trying to prey on desperate families. So that's one reason to not put your personal information on there. The second reason is investigators are trained to secure clues out of the public in a way that we as laypersons in the community would not be able to. If someone's calling in with a tip, you may have that one shot to get the information from that individual, because it's maybe an anonymous tip. You want an investigator who's trained in how to extract that data from that individual. And the other part of it that I really want people to understand is that harboring a runaway is a crime. Sometimes people think, oh, well, it's okay. They can stay here with me for a little while. They're having a fight with mom. Just be aware, you need to notify the parent as soon as possible that that individual is safe, because it is a crime to harbor a runaway. Now, if you believe there's something criminal going on in the home, there are steps that you can take to protect that individual. All of us here on this call are required by law to report abuse. And so it's just remember that harboring a runaway is a crime, and there are steps you can take to protect that child if for some reason you believe that child shouldn't be in the home.
That's a good reminder. I bet you would have people out there who think that, oh, someone ran away from their home. Let me just like take them in temporarily. Let's pivot a little bit. In the past, we've talked about forensic investigations and the importance of chain of custody, and in particular, the way we need to protect the defensibility of evidence in both criminal and civil matters. And to do that, we have to carefully proceed as we collect and preserve DNA. So can you walk us through how DNA data is entered in the context of a missing persons investigation?
You bet. And there are a whole lot of acronyms in this field, and I'm going to try to remember to define and identify what each of those acronyms are as we go through this conversation. So the first step for DNA collection to actually be tied to a missing persons case is you have to have that law enforcement report, that missing persons report. And so once a law enforcement case number is assigned, then law enforcement enters that information into NCIC or TCIC, and that's National Crime Information Center, or here in Texas, the Texas Crime Information Center. I always need a story in my head that will clarify what each of these databases may be. The NCIC, TCIC database, that's when, if you have a traffic violation, which I'm sure no one on here ever does, when their law enforcement is looking at your ID and your license plate, they're cross-referencing it with those databases to see if there's any crime associated with your vehicle or your individual self. So that's why that's step two, because that's going to be something that's more fast acting. You're not cross-referencing that with DNA. So that's why that is next. Then law enforcement enters the missing persons report into the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System. And that's NAMUS, which is kind of a clever Name Us acronym.
Uh-huh.
And that is the database that if there are any Jane or John Doe's found at a hospital or in a medical examiner's office, they can search by identifying markers in that database to see if this Jane or John Doe matches an existing missing person. And again, if you pay attention to what each of these things do, the order aligns with how quickly you might find individuals, right? A vehicle is going to be more likely to be found than a body in a field, if that makes mm-hmm. sense. And so law enforcement, within 30 days for juveniles and within 60 days for adults, enter that into NAMUS. And then next is the DNA swab. And the key part of that is folks should know it's not a blood draw. It's just a cheek swab. So it's a non-invasive situation. And it must be completed to be entered into any of these databases by either a sworn law enforcement officer or a medical examiner's office. So many people who maybe get these child ID kits that are mailed to them or someone trying to get you to pay to enter your child into a database, none of that's going to help you. You need it to be done by a medical examiner or a law enforcement officer to get into the databases that matter. I just want to touch on, you know, some parents get real excited about fingerprinting and DNA. The reality is those two tools to recover somebody, that's for identification, not recovery. So DNA and fingerprints is not to find a child safe. That is to identify a body after nature has run its course. So the best way to get your loved one home safe is have a good headshot. So that's just another sidebar. Yeah. So once DNA is entered, and the best DNA is to have two different family members on the mother's side of the individual be swabbed. And the more entries into the DNA system, the more likely you are to find a match. And it's faster if there's someone to match it to. So if you also know who might be the suspect, that's going to go through the system faster. And all of these things are run constantly across all the databases. And so once DNA is taken by a sworn law enforcement officer or medical examiner, then in Texas, it's submitted to the University of North Texas, their DNA lab, who then submits it to CODIS. And CODIS stands for Combined DNA Index System. So that's the process.
And CODIS is nationwide, right?
Correct. CODIS is nationwide. The part for Texas, University of North Texas, their lab actually has a twofold testing process, which we can talk about later. I don't know how much you want to get into that, but there's different levels of DNA profiles. And the North Texas lab for Texas has that higher level of detail.
We recently talked about CODIS, came up in a foul play episode regarding the Idaho murders. Wow. So I appreciate you explaining what CODIS is all about.
Yeah. So Mel, what are some common misconceptions that people have when it comes to collecting DNA evidence?
We've talked a little bit about it. It's specifically, there's no 24-hour waiting period to report a missing person. But there's also this misconception that as soon as you do a DNA swab, within 30 minutes, they're going to have an answer. That's not the case. Unless there's something to compare it to, it may be unsuccessful. But it's a critical part of the investigation process so that if an unidentified remains are found or if another criminal investigation should find some DNA that it can be cross-referenced, it can lead to the resolution of a case. I think it's important to remember no 24-hour waiting period. Law enforcement is required within 30 days or 60 days, depending on if it's a child, a juvenile, or an adult, to provide that opportunity to family. But they may not come to you. You may have to follow up with law enforcement. And it's just that speed is not as fast as we're taught to believe. And also that the DNA swab is, like I said, it's a swab. It is not any sort of blood draw. It's a non-invasive tool. And I want to point out, just because a recent case came up about this, if you have a child who's adopted because your DNA doesn't match that child, it would be a very good thing if you can find a way to get their DNA collected before anything should happen. Because if you are an adoptive parent and you're trying to find your loved one, if you don't have a relationship with the biological parents, how are you going to make that connection? So it would be important to talk to your local law enforcement agency on how to get that kind of pre-collected. Just a thing to share.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't have thought about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm curious, Mel, we've talked a lot about the different processes and alert systems that go into missing persons, but what happens in all of those wonderful cases you were referring to earlier when children and adults are found, but they have trauma afterwards and their family has trauma? So I know I wasn't the only person affected by my kidnapping. Certainly my parents were extremely traumatized as well. Are there services or any help out there for people that are kind of dealing with the aftermath?
Absolutely. And that's part of when I think I mentioned that part of our process is to do a 30, 60, and 90-day follow-up. And that is not only to find out, was the loved one found and if our services helped recover that individual, but also to find out what else that family may need. There are a lot of frequent flyer runaways out there. We try to connect families to resources to get those services. Here in Harris County, the Children's Assessment Center is an amazing resource. We have a database of service providers that run the gamut, whether it is how do we resolve whatever the challenges are in a home that the runaway is running away from? How do we get counseling for that individual? There's the Crime Victims Compensation Fund in the state of Texas. So let's say a child was lured away on a computer through digital communications. If it was the family laptop and law enforcement had to take it as evidence, how can we help them replace that laptop without it being a financial burden to the family? And you can go through that process through that Crime Victims Compensation Fund. It's just whatever the need is of the family, we are here to give them a referral and hopefully give them one phone number to call an individual so they don't have to go through the terrible automated phone systems that everybody uses.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sitting here listening to all of the things that your organization is responsible for, and it's daunting. I mean, for sure. And I had no idea that there was so much that went into the process of finding and alerting, you know, missing persons, and then everything that goes on after the fact. Part of me is sitting here thinking, like, holy cow, they must spend a ton of money. How do you get financial support? How do people help you guys? Because I know you said you're not government funded. What does that look like for our listeners who are interested in helping you guys keep going and keep doing all the important work that you're doing?
Well, we are a tiny but mighty organization. We have 3 full-time staff and 2 part-time staff. A big part of what we do is through partnerships and collaboration. We always would love to accept donations through online.centerforthemissing.org. But if you don't want to financially support Texas Center for the Missing, I call them our social media ambassadors. Just sharing a missing persons flyer can help find a missing person. Just keeping your eyes and ears open, being aware that we are here to help. There are many of the, like, my kids are in 2 different schools, and they'll say, hey, mom, on Instagram, so-and-so said so-and-so is missing. I said, make sure they contact us. Let us help the family. And just if you see anything like that, just tag us in the comments. We're on all the social media platforms. Stay educated. You can also invite us in to do a training within your community, whether it's at a PTO, if it's at a corporation for a lunch and learn, so people can learn about us, learn how to keep their loved ones safe, and learn what you can do to be an advocate for the missing. You don't know what you don't know. And until it happens to you, you're not going to have the information you need. And when you're in a state of panic, that's not when you educate yourself. It's before the bad stuff happens, so you know who to call.
And I mean, I can speak from personal experience. It's been years ago that the incident happened to me. And I'm still thinking of things that, gosh, I wish we would have done fill in the blank. Because this is in the 70s, of course. So a lot of this we weren't as sophisticated back then. But it's so easy just to get caught up in the actual trauma of the incident and not be logically thinking through the right steps. So I love that your organization is there to help and that you are open to educational opportunities. I do see on social media missing persons posts quite a bit, actually. And somebody flagged one for me, I think it was last week, and said, hey, you need to not share this because people are using this as, you know, bait to bait people to different sites and this is a scam. So don't post these. Mm. How do we know that what we're seeing is legitimately a missing person and not some sort of internet scam?
Primarily, I mean, it's simple as Googling it. And you can see if it's been reported by a law enforcement agency. If in doubt, I'm happy to be a resource for individuals. That's one of the reasons it's so important to share instead of like copy, paste, repost, so that, you know, that social media updates, it'll follow along with it. And then also, I think using certain benchmarks of who shared it. Was it just a friend, or was it from Texas Center for the Missing or a law enforcement agency? That's kind of step one. We do not post anything until we've confirmed that it's been reported to law enforcement and there is a case number assigned to it. And so that is kind of one threshold you can use to make sure that it's safe. And then take that extra step to Google, visit some of those myth-busting sites like Snopes before you start to perpetuate it, because there will be some that either they're scams or they've modified the picture in some way. And of course, don't ever click a link. if it's not from someone you trust implicitly.
Just so our listeners know, we are going to share the Texas Center for the Missing's information in the show notes, and we'll share it as we post on social media. So you'll have that information there for you. And we'll also provide you with Mel's information as well.
So Mel, I'm wondering what happens to survivors and their family members. Are there any resources that you want to point out for those folks?
Yes, especially for those who have survived a human trafficking incident. We hear over and over again that survivors' greatest fears and worries is that the images that are out there that were utilized, that were inappropriate images of themselves when they were being trafficked, are still out there. And I just want individuals to know that there's something called takeitdown.ncmic.org, where you can request that those images be removed, and partner social media and different locations on the web can start removing that information for you. And it's just another way to give a little bit of closure and resolution to those who have extricated themselves from human trafficking. And I just really hope if anyone needs access to those resources, they reach out to us.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, that is amazing. And so if our listeners are interested in finding out more about your organization, how can they stay in touch? Where can they learn more?
You bet. So our website is centerforthemissing.org, and we can be found on Facebook at TX Center. We can be found on LinkedIn at Texas-Center-For-The-Missing. We can be found on Instagram at TX Center for the Missing. And we can be found on YouTube at TX Center. And I will be sure to send those links to you guys if they want to include that in any notes. And our website has all of our contact information if you need anything. If you do have a missing loved one, there's a big orange button that says Get Help. Click on that and we will do everything we can to help you.
That's great. And Mel, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to be with Angie and I today. It's been an honor to have you and learn more about the Texas Center for the Missing. I personally am very grateful for organizations like you and people like you and your team who dedicate so much of their time to help families that have struggled with something that I can definitely relate to. And I would encourage you, if you're listening today and you've heard me talk about being kidnapped and sexually molested, and you're thinking, gosh, that's happened to me, but I really have been embarrassed to ever even talk about that. And I don't want to talk about that because it's so hurtful for me. I would encourage you, number one, to get some help for yourself from a counselor or therapist. I would also tell you, you're not alone and that this happens to so many people. And the more I share, the more I realize how actually it's a very frequent thing that happens. And it's also very common that people don't want to talk about it. But when we do talk about it, it helps us heal. When we do talk about it, it helps others to heal. And I honestly feel very blessed that God gave me the opportunity to heal from my own event and has put me in the path of other people that are going through something similar, because it empowers them to get better. And I feel grateful that I get to be used to do that. And so anyway, I just wanted to share that for anybody that's listening that might be pertinent to. But thank you so much, Mel, for taking the time to be here. It's been great to have you.
I just appreciate y'all shining the light on the issue. And thank you for what y'all do. Y'all are amazing women. It's proud to be in your circle.
Well, Yay. So are you. I think that brings us to the end of our show. Thank you so much for joining us on eDiscovery Chicks. We hope you learned something new, felt empowered, or just had fun along the way. Don't forget to join the flock by following us on LinkedIn and Instagram, and check out our website, eDiscoveryChicks.com. If you loved this episode, share it with your network, leave us a review, or tag us on your socials with your favorite takeaway. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. Catch us next time. Until then, flock on, friends.
The views we've expressed today are the eDiscovery Chicks views and don't necessarily represent the views of our employers, partners, or clients. This podcast is available solely for educational purposes to provide general information about eDiscovery principles and related topics, and not to provide legal advice to any specific situation. It is not a substitute for legal advice from a lawyer you've retained or who has agreed to represent you. Bye.
Bye.